So I have got... Originally, I just had one line of that song of Milarepa. One line. And it was, and is, with this good foundation, one should further pray to the three precious ones. I asked for another line. There was another line right at the end, which it seemed to me connected, which was, dear son, the virtue seeker, bear this instruction in your consciousness. So those are my two lines. And I wrote a talk, and then I threw it away the other day. It just wasn't fit for purpose. You know, one of these things you think, no, this isn't quite it. The notes are probably still in the recycling bin in the community, if you really want to know what I was going to say. But I'm going to say something completely different. When I was at Guhuloka last year, I was on the three-month order retreat at Guhuloka. Fabulous. You must do it if you can. Three-month order retreat. 2 months is good as well. Really, really very good. I experienced a lot of faith, actually. A lot of faith. And during that time, you probably know that one of my favourite sutras in the whole world is the Vimalakirti Nidesha. Love that sutra. And there's a section in chapter 7, the goddess, called the Great Love. And it's quite well known, isn't it? Pabhavaja has given a number of talks on it. I've given a couple of talks on it. Maitreya Bandhu gave a talk on it recently at Manchester. Really brilliant section, isn't it? It's where Vimalakirti tells Manjushri about the great love, the Maha Maitri. And the Thurman, the translator, said he didn't translate Maitri as friendliness or goodwill. He translated it as love, because love is a word we all know, and love. It's a word in our vocabulary, and it means something to us. And of course, we're frightened that people might mistake the great love for romantic love and all that kind of thing. But, of course, what happens, as Vimalakirti is talking about the great love, it becomes more and more obvious what he's talking about. It becomes clearer and clearer. No way is this any other kind of love. This is the great love. This is the Maha Maitri. So, while I was at Guhuloka, feeling quite a bit of faith, I began to write down some phrases as if Vimalakirti was talking about the great faith. So I'd be having dinner and another phrase would occur to me and I'd rush off down to my hut and write it down and I'd go back and have dinner and I'd be going for a walk and another one would come to me and I'd rush back and write it down. So I collected loads and loads of similes and phrases and so on. And at the end of the retreat, when I came back to England, I put them all together in a kind of an order. So I'm going to read it to you and then I'm going to talk about it. So traditionally, this is called giving an auto-commentary. I'm going to read you my text and then I'm going to do a commentary on the text, or at least parts of it. But before I do that, so it's in the style of a Mahayana sutra. You're probably thinking, who on earth does Ratnaguna think he is, writing a Mahayana sutra and then doing an auto-commentary? Well, I'm just me. So years ago, I don't know if you remember this, but when Banti was in America, he wrote some letters, which were published, I think, in Shabda and then into a book. And in those letters, he talks about reading this book, Pure Land Zen, Zen Pure Land, Patriarch Yin Kuang. And one of the things he writes about in those letters, one of the things he was really struck by was this, sutra recitation as a practice. When engaging in sutra recital, you absolutely must avoid the development of a discriminating mind. Do you remember that? Do you remember reading that, the Banti was talking about that? Probably not. So it's good I'm telling you again. You absolutely must avoid the development of a discriminating mind. And this is true, isn't it? When we listen to sutras, and that's the best way of encountering sutras is to listen to them in a ritual context. When you listen to them, at first your discriminating mind is working, isn't it? What does that mean? You know? And of course, the sutra goes on and on about the same topic, page after page. And after a few sentences, you think, well, I got that now, thank you. Can we move on to the next topic, please? Because I've understood that now. And it's almost like the sutra is saying, no, you haven't. You haven't understood it. I'm going to say it again now in a different way. Because you haven't understood it. And then you think, no, I've got it now. You haven't, you haven't, you haven't. And after a while, your discriminating mind gives up, doesn't it? You think, oh, I just can't think anymore. And then the sutra begins to speak to you. So, if you'll just indulge me, I'm going to read out this sutra-like recitation. And if you can, put down the discriminating mind and just let it affect you. Then Avalokiteshvara asked Amitabha, "What is needed above all in the quest to awaken for the sake of all beings?" Amitabha replied, "The great faith." Avalokiteshvara asked, "What is the great faith?" Amitabha replied, "The faith that is like gold, pure and brilliant in the sunlight. The faith that is like the sun shining in the cave of the heart. The faith that is like the sky, unbounded and limitless. The faith that is like fire, burning the impurities of the self. The faith that is the heart placed upon the three jewels. The faith that imagines the world anew, seeing with innocent eyes, bright, lucid and pure. The faith that is joy, rapture, calm, bliss, absorption, knowing and seeing things as they really are, serene withdrawal, dispassion, freedom and awakening. The faith that is natural, because it allows each stage of the path to arise naturally from the previous one, with no willed effort. The faith that is the Buddha's. The faith that is like a cup being filled to the brim and then brimming over. The faith that is like springtime, unstoppable, bursting forth everywhere. The faith that is like a child playing, full of joy. The faith that never engages in unskillful acts because they tarnish its brilliance. The faith that only performs skillful acts because they allow it to shine out, brightening and warming the whole world. The faith that is like a water purifying jewel, purifying the mind of the five hindrances. The faith that is like a strong man who leaps across to the other shore. The faith that is like a young child, innocent and unself-conscious of its own beauty. The faith that is like an excellent student, always willing to learn. The faith that is like a benevolent teacher, always encouraging his students to go further. The faith that is like travelling on a boat, easy and pleasant. The faith that is like a good-natured comedian who makes us laugh at our absurdities. The faith that is always present, even though sometimes obscured by selfish acts. The faith that is luminous, only defiled by adventitious defilements. The faith that is pure, like a drop of Vajrasattva's nectar, placed in the heart. The faith that has no second arrow because it doesn't resist suffering. The faith that is Pingyas, who is always with the Buddha. The faith that is like a wise elder who, when the young feel discouraged, tells them that their efforts will bear fruit all in good time. The faith that refreshes the mind as cold water refreshes the body on a hot day. The faith that is reasonable, but doesn't engage in conceptual proliferation. The faith that safeguards the truth by refraining from saying, only this is true, all else is false. The faith that doesn't argue with scientists, because it keeps to its own domain. The faith that is too happy to argue. The faith that is like meeting with an old friend and being gladdened at heart. The faith that meets obstacles with love. The faith that is like a traveller going to a country he has never previously been to and not knowing what he will find. The faith that longs for its consummation in wisdom as a man who has been many years away longs for home. The faith that is clear, longing, confident and irreversible. The faith that is purified and bright, malleable, wieldy, and radiant, ready to receive wisdom. The faith that is like being embraced by all the Buddhas. The faith that bows down to everything because everything bears the mark of reality. The faith that is not the self, but arisen spontaneously, free of self-willing. The faith that transcends both faith and doubt. The faith that is the Karma Niyama giving way to the Dharma Niyama. The faith that is self-power giving way to other power. The faith that is not one's own, because it connects us with everyone. The faith that has nothing, needs nothing, knows nothing, and is nothing, because there is no thing to have, grasp for, know, or be. The faith that, at the right time, bursts open the heart, leaving only unbounded happiness, free of the misery of selfhood. That, Avalokiteshvara, is the great faith. That's the text. Did sound a bit like a Mahayana Sutra, didn't it? So now for the auto-commentary. Yes, so I obviously don't have time to say comment on every one of those phrases. I'd be here all day if I was going to do that, so I'm just going to choose a few. I have to say that I've given a talk based on this text twice before, once in Blackburn and once in Stockholm, and in Stockholm it was recorded, and it's on Free Buddhist Audio, so you might have heard me talking about this text, but I'm going to try to say different things this time. So hopefully, you know, you won't feel shortchanged. Actually, in Stockholm, the person recording forgot to press the recording button until after I'd read that. So in the rest of the talk, people don't know what I'm talking about. Hopefully, we've recorded this time. So where should we begin? Let's begin with some of those epithets right at the beginning, shall we? Because Subhadra wasn't there for those, so we can hear this. The faith that is like gold, pure and brilliant in the sunlight. I was at Guhyaloka when I wrote this. So I was sitting in that grove of trees, and just beneath me was a stupa. And the top of the stupa is painted gold. Might even be gold leaf, but fantastic when the sun shines down on it. Isn't it wonderful? White and this gold top, the leaf, the gold leaf at the top. Absolutely brilliant. And I was feeling quite a lot of faith, and I just kind of resonated with this gold in the sunlight. I thought, that's what faith feels like to me. And here, I'm talking about faith as a mental state, not as belief. Yeah, big difference between the two. If you want to know more about that, by the way, there's a wonderful book called Faith and Belief, The Difference Between Them, by the great Wilfrid Cantwell Smith. Marvellous book. But faith as a state, and in the varieties of religious experience, is it? The varieties of religious, William James. He quotes somebody, it's either Professor Starbuck or Professor Luber, I can't remember which one. But they talk about religious experiences, he talks about them, whichever one it is, talks about the faith state. And I thought, that is a really good phrase, isn't it? The faith state. Yeah, the mental state that we call Shraddha or Prasada. So these epithets, they're more like evoking what that state actually feels like. Gold, pure and brilliant in the sunlight. The faith that is like the sun shining in the cave of the heart. So our inner being is kind of lit up by this sun in the cave of our heart. The faith that is like the sky, unbounded and limitless. I'm not going to say very much about that right now, because I'll say more about this aspect of faith a bit later. But usually the limitless and unbounded sky is usually a kind of epithet for wisdom, isn't it? Emptiness. But of course, my talk is called The Great Faith, Great Wisdom. And for me, it's maha. Maha, meaning great, but also empty. You know, shot through with wisdom. So faith and wisdom, can join together. Hopefully I'll say more about that at the end if I get time. The faith that is like fire, burning the impurities of the self. And I think that's what faith does. When you're in the faith state, it purifies you of your selfishness. Quite simply does that. Okay, then we come on to more kind of doctrinal points. The faith that is the heart placed upon the three jewels. Well, that's Shraddhal, obviously, isn't it? You all know, duh. Duh is the root, apparently, of Shraddhal, and duh means to place the heart upon. You all know that, don't you? Here's an interesting fact. Credo, same root. Credo, same root. Duh, meaning to place the heart upon. We don't like that as Buddhists, do we? Oh, no. Same as Christian. Same as Christian faith, but it's the same root. So Wilfrid Cantwell Smith talks about this, and he says there's a big difference between belief and faith. Yeah, belief is assenting to certain propositions. Faith is a completely different thing. What he says is the credo in B minor's Mass is not Bach saying, I believe this, this and this. It's an outpouring of his faith. In fact, you could say the whole of Bach's music, isn't it? It's just an outpouring of faith, not belief, but faith just pouring out of him. One piece after another. Incredible faith. Placing the heart upon. The faith that imagines the world anew, seeing with innocent eyes, bright, lucid and pure. Believe it or not, that's a doctrinal thing. Prasada, Sanskrit, or prasada in Pali, is faith, often translated as serene faith. Brilliant word. I think it's a word we need to take much more notice of. It means lots of things. It means faith, but it also means clarity. It means purity. It means brightness. In the Pali English Dictionary, prasada also means, it says something about colours of the eye. It's a bit mysterious, that, isn't it? Colours of the eye. So I nowadays think of prasada or prasada as the imagination. The imagination. It's the Mahayana kind of faith, the faith that imagines the world anew. So this is what I'm trying to get at here, the faith that imagines the world anew. It's what we're doing, isn't it? There's the clarity aspect of the Dharma, but there's also the imagining anew aspect of the Dharma. This is the same with reflection. There's an aspect of reflection which is you're clarifying the mind, but there's another aspect of reflection where you're creating. You're creating the mind. You're creating new states. You're creating a new world in a way. So the faith that imagines the world anew, seeing with innocent eyes, bright, lucid and pure. Innocent eyes. Just seeing with innocent eyes, as if you'd never seen the world before. You've never seen this person before. Completely new to you, fresh. Like, you know, in the springtime you get these leaves, don't you? Just tiny little baby leaves. Baby leaves that are this incredible colour green, and they're so fresh and innocent and pure. You can't believe it, can you? You think, what? How did that happen? It's incredible. That's what faith is like. Isn't it? When you're in that state, you just feel like one of these baby leaves, little baby leaf inside you. Here's another bit of doctrine, of course. The faith that is joy, rapture, calm, bliss, and so on. You recognise that. This is the spiral path. And the next bit is connected with that. So the next bit is the faith that is natural because it allows each stage of the path to arise naturally from the previous one, with no willed effort. This is the Chaitanya Sutta. Very interesting sutta. Vatsagamati will know this one very well. The Chaitanya Sutta is another slightly different form of the positive nidanas leading to awakening. Starts off with virtue. So independence among virtue arises freedom from remorse. State of mind, freedom from remorse. Clear conscience, we could say. Independence upon clear conscience arises joy, then rapture, and so on, all the way up to enlightenment. Now, what interests me about this sutra is with every stage, the Buddha says this. For instance, for the first one, between virtue to clear conscience, he says, for a person endowed with virtue, consummate in virtue, there is no need for an act of will. May freedom from remorse arise in me. It is in the nature of things that freedom from remorse arises in a person endowed with virtue, consummate in virtue. And he goes through the whole thing like that. There's no need for an act of will for someone with freedom of remorse to try and get to the state of joy. It happens naturally with no act of will, all the way up to enlightenment. So this is kind of naturalness. Dhammata is the word, dhammata. Sometimes the translators say natural. It's natural. It happens naturally. This seems to me to be extremely important. Very, very important. I've been interested in this sutta for a long, long time. What seems to happen is that when you concentrate on one stage of the path, let's say your ethical practice, when you really work on that, then the next stage arises naturally without you needing to try and get there. That's the... I've just said that, haven't I? So I've just said it again here. But what's interesting is that the Buddha says consummate in virtue. So consummate is sampanna, which means successful, complete or perfect. So it's not that you move all this way with no willed effort at all. There is willed effort, but the willed effort is just working on where you are now. Yeah. So work on your ethics and freedom from remorse will arise. When you get there, then you work on freedom from remorse. You intensify it, you deepen it, and then joy arises. You don't need to try to get to the next stage, joy. This is important, isn't it? You don't need to try to get there, it happens. Now, what really interests me about this is your mental state transforms, as it were, involuntary. You don't do it. It happens to you. It's involuntary. So there seems to be this dynamic of you work, let's call that skillful effort with your ethics, and then positive result is not willing. You don't will the positive result, it just happens. Your mental state transforms of its own accord. What's incredible about this sutra is it shows that your mental states transform of their own accord. So there's this willing, and then it happens. Willing, then it happens. This, it seems to me, is what we have faith in. Skillful effort followed by positive result. Why does that happen? The Buddha didn't say, oh, it happens because of this. He didn't say, it's not interested in telling us why. It just does. It just does. The only way is it true that this happens? Well, we can verify it for ourselves, can't we? By going through those stages, becoming ethically pure, and then see what happens, and then go from there, so you verify it. And it seems to me that this connects, here we are, connecting back to the text we're looking at. So what Milarepa says to the young shepherd is, with this good foundation, one should further pray to the three precious shores. What foundation's that? Dhyana. The foundation he's talking about is the young shepherd's experience of dhyana. He's had an experience of dhyana. So with that good foundation, then further pray to the three jewels. Why? Because now he's had an experience of this dynamic. Skillful effort leading to involuntary positive result. Yeah, he's had that experience. Now he's got some experience on which he can base his faith. And I don't know much about this, it just occurred to me this morning, that there is somewhere, I think, where the Buddha says that there's right view before you've had experience of dhyana, and then there's right view after your experience of dhyana. Is that any nods? No? Yes. No? Yeah, okay, yeah. And I don't quite know why that is, but the right view after dhyana is better than the right view before dhyana. And maybe one of the reasons is because now you've experienced the spiritual life in action. You've experienced that dynamic. Natural, the naturalness. And I think very often we what we really need to have faith is in that dynamic of skillful effort followed by positive result. Yeah. And when we think about the five great stages of the spiritual life, the just sitting, I think that's maybe where the just sitting comes in. So you do the mindfulness of breathing and you have to allow the positive result to arise. So years ago, everyone was reading this book, Philosophy as a Way of Life. Very, very, very good book. If you haven't read it, it's very worth reading. But there's this chapter 3 called Spiritual Exercises. It goes into four spiritual exercises of the ancient Greek philosophers. So he's talking about the Socratic dialogue here, Pierre Hadot. And he says, the same thing happens in every spiritual exercise. We must let ourselves be changed in our point of view, attitudes and convictions. And the word let is italicized. That's why I emphasized it. The same thing happens in every spiritual exercise. We must let ourselves be changed in our point of view, attitudes and convictions. Seems to me really important, that point. There's this sense in which we try to make the spiritual life happen. We try to will it. And, you know, this willfulness that we sometimes have, I think, is our urge to get to the next stage before we've really consummated, made perfect and complete this stage. We want to get to the next stage. And that's willfulness. And, of course, it doesn't work. It doesn't follow the sequence of pratitya samuppada here. So this connects with one of the epithets I use later. Where is it? Such a long text. Where is it now? Here we are, yeah. The faith that is like a wise elder who, when the young feel discouraged, tells them that their efforts will bear fruit. All in good time. So, all in good time has become my favourite phrase these days. It will happen. All in good time. And this is one of the wonderful things about faith, I think. That when you have faith, you know. It will happen. All in good time. You go on retreat wanting to go to the next stage. Oh, let's get to the next stage. And it doesn't happen. Doesn't happen to me anyway. It doesn't happen to you. It doesn't happen to me. And I used to get very, very frustrated. All these other people, I'm looking around. You do that, don't you, in the shrine room? You're having a horrible time. You look around. Everyone else is like this. And you think, don't you, that everyone else is... It's first, second jhana. Oh, look at him. He's in a stage of rapture. Look, he's... it never happens to me. Why can't that happen to me? And you're willing the next stage to happen. Of course, it's not going to happen to me because I'm not ready for that yet. But then what happens next is I begin to doubt. Don't doubt the spiritual life. I doubt my own ability to live the spiritual life. So then a whole load of trouble comes out of that. But all I need to remember is all in good time. All in good time. Maybe not even this life. Doesn't look like it to me. Not in this life. Maybe a previous, not previous life, maybe the next life, succeeding life. But all in good time. That's what our faith in Dharma is, isn't it? It will happen. It will unfold, but all in its own time. Don't worry about it. Don't worry. That's the big message, isn't it? Don't worry. Have faith. Faith is not the opposite of doubt, perhaps. Faith is the opposite of worry, perhaps. It just came to me there. It may not bear much scrutiny, but don't think about it too much. Anyway, so for me, it's the opposite of worry. Okay, I think I might be ready to move on to another phrase now. Obviously, we're not going to get through all these in the time we've got. Which should we go to now? Oh, yeah, the next one's good, I think. The faith that is the Buddha's. Not the Bodhisattva's, who's not quite yet the Buddha, but the Buddha. So, in Wilfrid Cantwell Smith's great work, The Faith and Belief, The Difference Between Them, there's a whole chapter on Buddhism, and he calls the Buddha a man of faith. When I first read that, it gave me a shock. Man of faith? No, he's a man of wisdom. Man of faith. And, of course, Bhante has pointed our direction towards the Gaurava Sutta, hasn't he? Gaurava Sutta. Just after his enlightenment. just after his enlightenment. He said, one suffers if dwelling without reverence or deference. Say that again, because I got it. Did it all wrong, didn't I? One suffers if One suffers if dwelling without reverence or deference. That's a very hard phrase to say. See if I can do better the next one. Now, on what Brahmin or contemplative can I dwell in dependence? This is the Buddha after his enlightenment. On what Brahmin or contemplative can I dwell in dependence, honouring and respecting him? He looks around the universe, can't find it, can't find anyone. So he decides he's going to revere the Dharma. Very important, this, isn't it? Very important, he's going to revere the Dharma. Now that suggests, doesn't it, that the Dharma goes beyond the Buddha. He can't find a contemplative or Brahmin to revere. So if he can revere the Dharma, it means the Dharma is in some way beyond the Buddha. And this is in one of their papers, Subhuti Banti's papers. They talk about the Buddha beyond the Buddha, Amitabha, the Buddha beyond the Buddha, representing perhaps the fact that maybe the end of the spiritual life, awakening, is not really the end. Yeah, maybe it's the beginning of something new. Banti once talked about it as the horizon. That's as far as you can see, isn't it? Then as you walk to the horizon, it recedes away from you, doesn't it? So maybe what this means is that the Buddha had faith. Even the Buddha had faith. And this whole thing about him wanting someone to revere surprised me when I actually looked at this text. The Buddha's saying, one suffers if dwelling without reverence or deference. One suffers. He doesn't say, if there's someone around the place who's wiser than you, it's a good idea to revere them. He doesn't say that. He says, you suffer if you don't have someone to revere. It's almost like it's, I don't know, part of the fabric of the universe, or maybe the fabric of the human mind, that we need something or someone to revere, to look up to. The faith state. So out of that came a couple more similes. So the faith that is the Buddha's, the faith that is like a cup being filled to the brim and then brimming over, spilling over. That's, for me, what faith is. It kind of spills out, spills over. It's abundant. The faith that is like springtime, unstoppable, bursting forth everywhere. The faith that is like a child playing, full of joy. This sense of joyfulness and abundance, unstoppable. Can't keep it in. That's where, actually, generosity comes from, isn't it? Generosity isn't a willed thing. It sort of pours out of you when you're in the faith state. It just pours out of you. Just comes out like that. You can't help being generous when you're in a faith state. When you're inspired. You know, it's great as being a Dharma teacher, isn't it? Because you have to get into a good state. If you're not in a good state before you start teaching, you very quickly get into one. It just happens, doesn't it? Magic. And then suddenly you're really generous, you know, really sort of looking people in the eye and talking to them and answering questions and helping out. And you even go and make the tea, don't you? You go and make the tea for everyone. And it's just so easy. It's so simple. It's effortless. Because the faith state is just brimming. It's just pouring out of you. Tremendous. Am I being a bit much here? Just a bit too much stuff, isn't it? Some of you might think, whoa. So let's move on to another one then. What should we do next? Let's come down to earth a bit. The faith that is reasonable but doesn't engage in conceptual proliferation. So faith is not unreasonable. It's not irrational. It might go beyond faith, beyond reason, but it doesn't contradict reason. It's reasonable, but it doesn't engage in, you know, papancha, which somebody said once was ludicrous dialogue. Isn't that a good translation of Papantia? Ludicrous dialogue. Don't we get into that a lot? Ludicrous dialogue, end up arguing over ridiculous things. I can't find the bit I'm looking for, so I'll read another bit instead. The faith is like meeting with an old friend and being gladdened at heart. So we're all experiencing that at the moment, aren't we? You know, look, there's David Mitchell, I haven't seen him for ages. There's Sagamati, all my old friends, Suvadra. Just old friends. And isn't it great feeling, just being gladdened at heart? And my experience of faith is similar, because I don't always feel faith, to be honest. But sometimes when it comes back, it is like meeting with an old friend, this feeling of gladness at heart. This is feeling, oh, we're meeting again. Brilliant. And I've just remembered, I need to go back because there's an important bit that I missed it out. Here we are. The faith that never engages in unskillful acts because they tarnish its brilliance. The faith that only performs skillful acts because they allow it to shine out, brightening and warming the whole world. So faith and ethics, very important connection here. It's amazing, isn't it, that according to the Abhidharma, faith is present in every skillful mental state, in every positive mental state. Faith is present. Now that tells you a lot about faith, that it's not belief in certain things. Unless these Abhidharma scholars thought that no one but Buddhists could feel faith. That means that whoever's in a positive state of mind, whoever's helping someone out, loving them, being generous, they are feeling Shraddha. Well, they might not feel it, but they have got Shraddha in them. It says a lot about faith, that. And you know what it's like when you go on retreat and you get there in not the best state. It's true, isn't it? Tired, a bit stressed out. In your stressful life, you've done a few things that you're not that happy with, and so you come a little bit battered by the world and a bit feeling a bit remorseful, and you sit down and meditate, and it all comes out, doesn't it? You have to live it all again, and you just, oh, I really must confess this, and after a few days, you begin to feel better, don't you? You begin to feel better, and then after a few more days, you begin to feel brilliant, absolutely brilliant. Sometimes, not always, but you know, you come out of the shrine room and wow, the world. It's incredible, isn't it? Green grass and the oak tree. Whoa! And the sky, and it's all like, whoa, it's really big, isn't it? It's like really, whoa! How come I didn't see this before? The faith state, seeing anew with eyes lucid and pure. But what's happened is you've purified your karma, of course. You've just been purifying your karma. And you're a bit more pure now. So now you've got this pure state of mind. And this connects with, dear son, the virtue seeker, bear this instruction in your consciousness. Interesting that, isn't it? The virtue seeker, he calls him right at the end. He doesn't say the wisdom seeker. He says the virtue seeker. This is important, I think. So you've got the three levels of wisdom, ethics, meditation, and wisdom. And in Damien Keown's book, The Nature of Buddhist Ethics, he makes a really interesting point. He says, usually we see them as a hierarchy, don't we? You start with ethics, then you go on to wisdom, then you go on to meditation, then you go on to wisdom. He says, looking at the texts, it doesn't seem to be quite like that. When you look at those texts where the Buddha talks about the wise man, like the Parabha Sutta, is it Parabhava? Parabhava Sutta from the Sutta Nipata, for instance. When you read those texts carefully, what the Buddha's describing is the wise man's way of seeing the world, the wisdom, but also the behaviour in the world. So the wise man is both wise and ethical. So Damien Keown thought that actually maybe we could see the threefold way in a different way, that meditation helps you not only to become wise, but also to become ethical. Both your ethics and your wisdom come out of your practice of meditation. It's that interesting way of looking at it. But it's true, isn't it, that as you meditate, you do become more ethical. You become more ethical inside. Your inner states are more ethical. And then you begin to act from that. And, you know, you come out of a retreat and you're purified. You've got this prasada, this new way of looking at the world, and you feel like gold inside and the sun is shining in your heart. You go back to your world and then you do something which isn't the best thing to do. And it does tarnish that, doesn't it? That bright feeling in the heart is tarnished. And you feel, oh, what a pity. What a pity I had to do that. That's what happens. 12:45, everybody. So we want to finish about 10 to, don't we, so that Amalavadra can make his announcement. So let's come to a finish. Let's finish with the last couple of bits. The faith that is not the self, but arisen spontaneously, free of self-willing. The faith that transcends both faith and doubt. The faith that is the Karma Niyama, giving way to the Dharma Niyama. The faith that is self-power, giving way to other power. So, in my book, Karma Niyama is self-power. Dharma Niyama is other power. Self-willing is the use of the self-power mode wrongly. It's that willingness, trying to get to the next stage before you're really ready to get there. But self-power is simply the skillful effort you make. Other power is the positive response. Yeah, it's what happens as a result of that. So Dharma Niyama to Karma Niyama, giving way to the Dharma Niyama. Did I dig it that way? Karma Niyama, Dharma Niyama. Self-power, giving way to other power. The first, the shorter Sukhavati Vyuha Sutra, towards the end, the Buddha says to Shariputra, "You may call this sutra embraced by all the Buddhas." Isn't that great? Embraced by all the Buddhas. That's the Dharma Niyama taking you. Yeah? You can only go so far, and then the Dharma Niyama takes you. St. Gregory Palamas, I think his name is, Greek Orthodox. There was this big debate in Christianity, wasn't it, hundreds of years ago, between faith and works. You know, is it faith or is it your works that get you into heaven? And he came up with this idea, the doctrine of synergism. Synergy, which is used in modern management and so on, isn't it? We've got a bit of synergy going between us here. Synergy comes from the Greek Orthodox Church. Isn't that amazing? The doctrine of synergism, which is you doing your bit, you self-effort, and then God does his bit. He comes to meet you. And this is exactly what happens in the Shorter Sukhavati Vyuha Sutra. Three things you need to gain access to the Pure Land. First is pranidhana. Pranidhana, you heard that word, which usually we think of as the Bodhisattva vow. But David Welsh translates as heartfelt desire. That's the first thing. Second thing is ethical practice, roots of virtue, kusala mula. The third is meditation on Amitabha or Amitayas. That's your bit. And then at death, Amitabha comes to meet you. That's the Dharma Niyama coming. So you've got all the way up to absorption. Yeah, it's the spiral path all the way up to absorption. And then Amitabha comes to, come on, I'll take you the rest of the way. Brilliant. This is all we need, isn't it? That's all we need to do. You just need to do the stuff that we're doing, ethics, meditation, and so on. And then wisdom just takes care of itself. Fantastic. 11:55. So I'll finish. The faith that is not one's own, because it connects us with everyone. The faith that has nothing, needs nothing, knows nothing, and is nothing. Because there is no thing to have, grasp, for, know, or be. The faith that at the right time bursts open the heart, leaving only unbounded happiness, free of the misery of selfhood. That, Avalokiteshvara, is the great faith.